You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Dr. Ron and it's great to have you on board. According to Hitwise, 86% of Australians use Google as their search engine of choice. Now that's a large proportion. Last week we spoke about search engine optimization and how you can maximize your website's exposure to the world's largest search engine. If you're in the business of designing websites, you're going to want them to appear in at least the first few search results of a Google query, if not the first result. If you're not in the business of website design, then you should be asking your web developers what they're doing to maximize your exposure on Google. This week, Tech Talk Radio's very own Lydia Davis has secured an exclusive interview with Adam Lasnik. Adam is Google's first ever search evangelist. What does this mean? Well, Adam works to improve communications between webmasters and Google itself, and Lydia's interview gives us a unique insight into the directions which Google is taking with its internet search engine technology. Also this week, Microsoft Live Labs has announced its new web browser for mobile phones, which is called DeepFish. This delivers so-called as-designed web pages to your mobile handset. This is an admirable task on the part of Microsoft, but it has reignited the debate between web page content puritans and supporters of the controversial .mobi namespace. Compared with desktop computers, we know that mobile devices will always have a smaller screen, limited bandwidth, and much less processing power. So, do we really need a browser on our mobile phone that supports JavaScript, ActiveX, Flash, cascading style sheets, and cookies? Or are we better off with custom-built websites in their own corner of the internet that load quickly and reliably on mobile devices? Well, we're going to tell you how to judge for yourself by registering to preview DeepFish with Microsoft Live Labs.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Australian consumers welcome a mobile data price war, Telstra cuts its paper bills, Apple supports album format, and web searches heat up. All this and much more on Australia's premier technology talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making technology headlines.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Telstra cuts paper bills, Apple supports an album format, Microsoft unveils a mobile browser, and the web search wars heat up. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Vodafone has fired the first return volley in the mobile data price war sparked off by Hutchison early this week. Data download costs on Australia's second and third generation mobile phone network have traditionally been exorbitant, with operators charging as much as $15 per megabyte, which puts the cost of downloading a typical 2 megabyte MP3 music file at a ridiculous $30. Vodafone has slashed mobile data charges on its 3G phone network, cutting its 1 gigabyte monthly capped plan from $99.95 to just $59.95 and introducing a $79.95 a month 2 gigabyte capped plan. Voice calls are extra and excess charges are 30 cents a megabyte. Hutchison's 3 is still the mobile data price leader with its 2GB plan costing just $40 a month and its 1GB plan going for $30 a month. Telstra charges a hefty $179 monthly fee for a 2GB mobile data plan on its new NextG network. 500,000 Telstra customers will start receiving a single monthly bill for their communication services, saving the company 8 tonnes of paper a year. Telstra customers involved in the Green Initiative will be notified that instead of receiving separate bills for their various services from the telco, they will now have one consolidated monthly bill. Telstra's Group Managing Director, Consumer Marketing and Channels, David Moffat, said this was the first of several billing initiatives that were part of the company's transformation project, with a new bill format to be introduced in the months ahead. Apple is throwing its weight behind the music industry's effort to protect the album format by allowing fans to buy complete digital albums without having to pay again for songs they already own. The record industry is keen to maintain the profitable album format, which is under threat as users of web-based music download stores such as Apple's iTunes and Napster prefer to buy individual songs rather than whole albums. Apple said it was introducing a Complete My Album service that offers customers who want to turn individual tracks into an album a 99-cent credit for every song they have already purchased from the album. For example, if a customer had bought three 99-cent singles and decided to download the entire album with a listed price of $9.99, the customer would only have to pay $7.02. Apple said fans will only be able to take advantage of the discount within 180 days after buying the songs. US software colossus Microsoft has unveiled a prototype of a mobile internet browser designed to mirror the ease of going online via a desktop computer. Microsoft Live Labs director Gary William Flake said, "Think about your mobile browsing experience today. It's often less than intuitive, the pages don't look like what you've come to expect on the desktop, and it takes a long time for the page to load. Deep Fish aims to solve that problem. Instead of relying on websites being tailored for mobile devices, Deep Fish captures and delivers, as designed, views of online pages of all kinds, according to Microsoft. Users can also zoom in or out on selections of web pages." Microsoft said it was releasing a Deep Fish prototype to get feedback from users and that it remained to be determined when a final version might be rolled out for the public. The battle for devotion of people who use the internet on the go intensified last week as Google unveiled a new mobile internet search engine. Google made its new mobile search engine available to the public on the same day that Sunnyvale, Californian-based rival Yahoo, enticed website publishers to enhance the OneSearch mobile search engine Yahoo released earlier this year. Google said they were making their new mobile search openly available so everyone can take it for a spin. The next time you visit google.com on your mobile phone, you'll see a link that will take you to a mobile search experience that's more tailored to your needs. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The United States, CD yes. sales absolutely plummeted.
Effectively, they're using the Telstra sale to fund broadband infrastructure in Australia.
And then you hear these pollies talking about all sorts of things like, well, you know, you're going to steal from the Future Fund. Well, hang on. This is the future.
We won't have a future if we don't have good quality broadband in this country.
The government has actually been out there for the past 2 years investing in broadband in underserved areas in rural, regional and remote Australia.
Last week we talked about doing 10 questions. We've got a few little responses from that. There's some people out there with some very strange senses of humour.
Hey, uncapped ADSL 1.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now we digress a bit here. We've got a show to do and we're running over.
Let's go. Not making a phone. Go away.
Just call me simplistic here.
They've got a prop up the pay TV networks that spent far too much rolling out duplicate infrastructure. And if we do the same thing in broadband, we'll be in the same messed up state in 10, 20, 30 years' time.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one. Download and install some podcatching software, like iTunes. Step 2. Find the address of the Tech Talk Radio podcast feed on the Tech Talk Radio website. Step 3. Copy and paste the feed address into your podcatching software. And you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
poor car
visiting the relatives,
hard
washing
in
the
Charlie
car.
Christie.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And how the time flies. We're back here again. Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another Tech Talk Radio for 2007. We're churning through them. Easter is almost upon us. And Dr. Ron and Mark Diggins join us on the panel this evening. Good evening, gentlemen.
G'day, Andrew. Good to be back on board.
Yeah, g'day, Andrew. G'day, Ron.
What's news? Anything happening exciting in your world?
Nothing in mind this week. We're getting a new premises, but other than that,
it's been a very hectic week for me, but it's just the usual run rate sort of business that I've been ploughing through.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lots in the news this week. How about yours, Mark?
Yeah, I was checking out some of the news today. In my personal world, I was speaking to someone about WiMAX.
That was a technology that they tried to introduce.
Well, it's still going ahead in the States, and this is where this guy was, so I was having a word to him. So
is it going
to
happen here, though?
I don't know. I don't honestly know. I haven't heard anything about it in Australia, but it's definitely rolling out in the States, and this is where he's involved. And he's got some good, like, not him himself, but the way they're selling it and the idea behind it sounds quite good. So we'll see what it comes of it when it actually launches.
I think service providers like iBurst and people like that are running WiMAX networks on a fairly limited basis at the moment.
Is that the technology they use, is it?
I believe so, yeah. And it's, I don't know the protocol off the top of my head, but it's 802.11 something or .12 something. I'm trying to remember the specification number. But yeah, it's being rolled out slowly.
Because there was supposed to be all these laptops coming out that were all WiMAX compatible. And
yeah, they're coming still. They're going to be built into all the Intel chipsets, he tells me. And, you know, his plan is, well, not his plan, but the plan of the telco he works for is to have, like, just say your video camera would have a WiMAX chip in it, and then you would have WiMAX, not hotspots, but just like a mobile phone network, a WiMAX network out there, and you'd be able to upload that video straight up to your website.
Is it going to be a bit superfluous now that we've got NextG and all the HSDPA type data around?
Yeah,
is there
in
any
Australia,
difference?
I think the reason that they want to build the actual WiMAX into the device as opposed to connecting it up to your mobile or to your laptop. You'd want
so it's
to
like your Wi-Fi. It's in and running.
Yeah, that's right.
When
and it's a bit like when you started looking at internet radios, where it's got the Wi-Fi built in and the Skype phone that was Wi-Fi built in, that sort of thing. It's like, here's the device. It's a video camera first, and it just happens to have connectivity through WiMAX and that sort of thing.
The other application for WiMAX that I'd heard was doing the backhaul part of the networking as well, Mark and Andrew. The Wi-Fi is something which we're using quite a lot now in Australia, and you're seeing it in all your devices, your PDAs and your laptops and things like that. And I think WiMAX, a lot of people looking at that maybe as a backhaul alternative to link all the Wi-Fi hotspots together.
Yeah, that's,
and bring the Wi-Fi hotspots back into the network potentially.
That would be quite possible, yeah, for sure.
Just to remember, let me start again. Just a reminder to everyone, we are streaming online. We have a two-hour program here. If you're listening to the one-hour show, check out the podcast. There'll be all sorts of interesting things in there, which you may not hear in the one-hour program.
We rabbit on for 2 hours in real life.
We do. We do. It's very hard cutting back the one-hour program, let me tell you. Emails this week. I have an email here from a listener. This is from Andrew from Earthlink Design. He sent us an email the other day. Starts off, me again. my other hat that I wear is I run an ISP called earthlink.com. There you go, there's a free plug. And we run on the outer fringes of Melbourne in Lilydale, and the amount of users that still can't get ADSL in the Yarra Valley is unreal. The Yarra Valley, what would you say? Half an hour to an hour to the east of town, heading up into the hills?
That would be right, outer eastern suburbs, yeah.
There's one major issue after another, including old exchanges, RIMs, and even, I don't know what that means, what's an RIM? Apostrophe S, that's an acronym I'm not familiar with.
Yep.
And even if you're in range of the phone line, they're so old that the tests fail. Well, that's the problem with country DSL, really, isn't it? You know, the old farmers used to run the phone line up the paddock through the fencing wire. High-frequency component's certainly going to fall off, I would think,
and while that was,
as it traverses the gate. Have you shut the gate, dear? We want to use ADSL tonight.
And that could barely support a normal telephone call, a normal telephone circuit, and it'd be crackly and noisy, but you'd just be able to get it through. But when it comes to data, it will not make the grade.
Oh, 9600, come on.
9600 board,
maybe
dial-up,
1200
potentially.
Is.
Yes.
Yeah. Now on to ADSL2 porting. This is also from Andrew. It won't happen until Telstra sign up for it, as some ISPs with ADSL2 have. But if the big T doesn't, then porting's not going to be a good option. Churning on ADSL1 works fine now, as all major ISPs are on board. Good point. His email does go on, but that's for another night, I think.
Thanks for the feedback, Andrew. Keep us posted. Let us know what happens there and what your customers are going to be doing in the long term.
Yep. Andrew sent us an email to feedback@techtalkradio.com.au, which is how you can get in touch with us right now. Let me get off the browser here on the screen. We'll get back to email. We might be able to see some people talk to us. Now, gents, I just absolutely hit the deck last night at around about 10 o'clock when Google put their new little April Fool's gag up on the World Wide Web.
Was it an April Fool's joke? I thought that was a great idea.
Ah, sensational.
Yeah. Until you see the photo.
I was sitting there and I was reading away and I thought, oh, what's this? They've, you know, the little red thing, you can't miss it on the Google login page. It says new. I said, oh, well, got to have a click of this. And as I read on, at least the opening page, it says, welcome to Google TISP, which is basically broadband down the toilet sort of thing is what they're doing now. It says, introducing Google TISP Beta, our new free in-home wireless broadband service. Sign up today and we'll send you your TISP self-installation kit, which includes setup guide, fiber optic cable, spindle, wireless router, and installation CD. Now,
is it toilet ISP? Is that what it
that's
is?
That's right.
Okay, gotcha.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm with you so far. This is sounding good.
And I'm reading here going, oh, yeah, this sounds interesting. Yep. And I hadn't quite glanced at the picture to the right of my screen by this stage. It comes back and it says, TISP in the home wireless broadband is free, fast, and highly reliable. Easy to install, just takes a few minutes, and vacuum sealed to prevent water damage. Now, at that point in time, I thought,
hang on a minute.
Anyway, the press release came out, but in a nutshell, what this is you get a kit in the kit, and by all means, this will be our website of the week without a shadow of a doubt. If you go to Google right now, google.com.au, providing you're listening to us live, you'll probably see it. It'll still be there. They'll probably take it down tonight or tomorrow. It's you'll see the package there. Comes complete with rubber gloves, lovely yellow ones, a modem. Someone's mocked up the artwork and it looks really...
It's a fiber optic modem, isn't it?
Well, apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently. But the rubber gloves, I think, is really quite good. But what you do, in essence, is you flush this thing down the toilet and there's a man in the sewer that actually connects it up into the node.
Well, that's right. You drop the end of the cable into the S-bend of your toilet.
Complete with sinker, wasn't it?
That's right.
That's right. They put a sinker. Now, go and have a look because you can follow along with the pictures. The pictures work really well.
When the end of the fiber optic cable that you've got actually reaches a little man in the sewer, he plugs it into a new Google-sponsored... optic fiber router.
Now, the little man's called, he's got a PhD, and I'm just trying to find what the acronym stuff. Here we go. Plumbing Hardware Dispatchers.
Yeah, the Plumbing Hardware Dispatchers are in the sewer. That's right.
That's right. And there's a picture of a man, like it's a caricature artwork thing of a man with his breathing apparatus on, coming up with his Cat 5 cable in hand. They've got a new patented system called G Flush,
Google Flush. Now I got into trouble for this because
that's enough of that.
You had upload problems, but not download problems or something. And emailed it to me.
Works really well. Downloading's not a problem, but the upload's a bit messy.
I said try putting the lid up, but I copied it to lid, and then
our lid in the States.
She's not talking to me now.
So I noticed that she didn't respond to that email. You're in trouble now.
Very good.
Dear. So we digress.
New definition to a firewall, isn't it?
Yes.
Dear. Let's talk seriously now. High-speed digital packet, what's the A stand for? Access. HSDPA.
Yes.
Everyone's nodding in here.
Yes, radio. Nodding. I should be saying yes,
that's
it
right.
is access.
Doesn't work well on radio.
It's all happening out there in HSDPA land at the moment. We've had some of these new carriers come on and put their money where their mouth is. Hutchison's came out this week and announced some absolutely unbelievable prices. Excuse me. Unbelievable prices for HSDPA compared to existing telcos. Optus have come out and said, we might get around to it by June. But
what
at the
is
moment-
Optus doing? They have, that's bizarre. They've actually had nothing at all in the press about their pricing or their 3G network or data plans or anything like that.
I don't know. Maybe they're in trouble. Since Singtel bought them, maybe they're on the Google Flush. They're using G-Flush technology.
They might be using G-Flush technology on their mobile phone network. Yeah, now you've actually got a little new chart up on our website,
yes.
Andrew, haven't you? Tell us about that.
On the Tech Talk Radio website, if you're interested, and I'm actually going to embellish this and turn it into a page very shortly. If you're looking at data plans, and I think people should think of data as separate from voice. It's you don't necessarily have to use a SIM from the same company or provider that you're using.
This is data on your mobile telephone we're talking about.
Yeah, now you can either get a device, and Mark should be telling this, but you can get a device which is ready to use the high-speed downloads, or you can get a laptop like we've got sitting here on the bench in the studio, which plugs into the technology, and away you go. Because it's a bit hard actually surfing on the phone and talking on the phone at the same time, unless you're wirelessly connecting and things like that. But we're going to do that on the webpage so you can read all about it. And if you go there right now, you'll see today's prices, which is quite interesting. It says here, clicking the link and hopefully going there. There they all are, sitting there. Included data, which tells you what you get, how much data is included in the money that you pay. It compares the three providers. that we've got there at the moment. And column on the left is what you pay as the cap, I guess, or the actual access point. So you pay $59 or $29. And to the right is your excess bandwidth charges. So have a look at that. That's on the Tech Talk Radio website.
That's per megabyte, Andrew, the excess charges?
It is. Mm. It is. And yes, you'll see what we mean. And this war is just kicking in now. Vodafone have got in on the action. Everyone's sort of beating it up. So here we go. It's a bit like, I don't know what it's like. It's sort of like when telephones first came out, mobile first came out, the call costs were incredibly expensive. Then as competition came into the market, things plummeted. And now we're seeing incredible caps and good value for money. Although your colleague who was in the other day, Anton, was his name, he seemed to think that it was his opinion that we were paying a reasonable rate for bandwidth in this country. Mark says
he's had some experience, particularly in Europe and a little bit in the States as well. So I'd trust what he says. I don't know. He hasn't been overseas out of Australia for probably 12 months, so mm-hmm. things may have changed in that time.
Well, hopefully we're going to see some competition in the wireless broadband access.
Yeah, and we've got to actually, you're going to put a little write-up on there about the differences between the different providers, aren't you?
Well, exactly right, because not all providers use the same technology, and there are limitations, and that's what I was saying before, we'll embellish it a little bit, and we'll put a page up in the next little bit, so you can go along and read about our thoughts about what you want to do, and try. Hopefully we'll give you some guidance there, as if you want to use a laptop, this is how to do it. If you want to use a PDA, this is how to do it.
Yeah, so expect to pay a premium compared to home broadband stuff because you've got the advantage of having mobility. So you'll pay a premium for that. And then on top of that, there'll be difference between carriers depending on what they offer. So someone like Hutchison might offer, they offer their 2100 service, megahertz service in capital cities, but if you go to Hobart, not there, you go back to GPRS and that sort of thing. So others that provide it everywhere will
We're going to need two SIMs, one for provider A, one for provider B, depending upon what our habits are, because that's what it comes down to, isn't it?
And if you're only using in the capital cities, not a problem, you can go with the cheaper one, but if you need it to travel around, that's why you're getting the mobility function to use it with your mobile or mobile device.
Mark mentioned GPRS then. That's the data layer on the GSM network, on the older network, and that's akin to the HSDPA, which is the data layer on the new third generation networks.
All exciting. Now, we spoke about Google's a little press release, which I thought was a great April Fool's joke, and was. Microsoft released something earlier on the same day, which I thought was an April Fool's gag too. But
they were deadly serious.
But they were serious.
Uh-oh.
How on earth or why would you call a web browser deep fish?
Bizarre, isn't it?
It's there's not even any reference to Douglas Adams or anything like that, like there is in Adam from Google. They've got a great sense of humor around there, I think. So, but yeah, deep fish. Now this is a browser which seems to think that it will display what a website looks like on your mobile device. It does some jiggery pokery to make it work for you. But can I just say that I have a lovely phone that sits here on the desk, and it does it for me already. So why do we need fish, deep fish? I can't get my mind around deep fish.
Deep fried fish.
So is this like you look at it with your laptop or your home computer and it'll give you the simulation as though you were looking at it onto a mobile device?
So you can look at a mobile device and it gives you the appearance that it's what you would expect on the web page looking on your laptop desktop at home.
Yep.
But I think there's a lot of software that's actually already being gone down that path.
Microsoft have committed a lot of resources and time and development effort to a deep fish. And I've been unable to register myself as a tester. They've closed all the beta registrations and things like that. But keep an eye on their website. You might be able to sneak in there somehow and register yourself and get a beta version of deep fish and have a play around with it. I was a bit confused because we're on the other side of the fence, we've got the whole .mobi domain space, and there are a lot of people who are pushing for the custom-built pages for small-screen devices. With a small-screen device, you've got less processing power, you've got smaller screen, obviously, you've got less bandwidth, and you've got more expensive bandwidth.
More expensive, yeah.
So I don't know that necessarily this is the solution or if it's the answer for everybody. It's going to be hard to say, and we're just going to have to wait and see until it's released and what people think, and see if it's useful.
No worries. Just an email in from Andrew. A correction. We're earthlink.com.au. Okay, good. Earthlink.com is a big US ISP. Don't go to the US ISP.
No, stay with .au. Sorry, Andrew.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Mark Diggins, and myself tonight. We're talking about search engine optimization in a big time. We're going to be talking to the Google Meister himself, Adam Lasnik from Googleplex. Lee did an interview. And yes, back with more and that in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Coming soon, we welcome Adam Turner to the Tech Talk Radio studio. Adam was formerly Melbourne Deputy Editor of Next, the business IT section of the Melbourne Age and Sydney Morning Herald. Adam went freelance in 2005 after 7 years at The Age. He still writes the Upgrade Product Review column in Next and contributes news, features, reviews and blogs to various technology publications, including The Age's Green Guide, Australian Personal Computer Magazine and the IT Wire News website. His speciality, the ever-changing digital lounge room, where broadband, digital television and entertainment technologies converge. We've all read Adam's column in ITY and know his frustration with the current government's broadband policy and the attitude of Australia's incumbent telco, Telstra. Tune in to what's sure to be a lively and colourful discussion when Adam Turner joins the Tech Talk Radio panel, coming soon on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1300 664 882 and leave a voice message. That's 1300 664 882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Search engine optimization, it's a wonderful thing. Dr. Ron, we went to that lovely seminar not so long back with Net Registry. They told us all sorts of good things about how to revolutionise and update our websites.
It was a great afternoon, and there are so many simple things, devastatingly simple, and you think, is that all I have to do?
Yep.
And as long as you dot the I's and cross the T's, you're going to increase your chance tremendously of having really good exposure in Google.
Now, I've already done some of the new little tips and tricks that we've got. Lyd gave us a beautiful one the other day. You're about to hear that in the interview that we just did. But it's well worth, whether you're just starting out doing websites, whether you've been doing them for years and years, the information is applicable to all. And it does. It makes a big difference out there.
Can I ask a quick question? When you're talking about optimization for Google, does that optimize for other search engines as well, or you just don't even bother with them because they're such a small percentage?
In a word, yes.
Okay.
In a word, yes.
So same theories apply for MSN or something like that.
That's right. But let's face it. According to Hitwise, which is one of the big monitoring companies in Australia that monitor internet behaviour, they get their statistics through ISPs, what people are browsing to. So it's all anonymous. They don't know.
Yep.
But Hitwise tells us at the moment that Google has around about 86% share of the market.
Engine. Okay, now, so it's not even worth bothering with the others.
If you look at the others, and you can go to their page. If you go to hitwise.com.au and click on the link and look on the down the bottom right-hand corner, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but you'll see it when you'll know it when you see it. You can see even, I think the next nearest one was Yahoo. I should bring it up on the screen here, but I can't do it while we're on air. And that was about 4%.
Okay.
So in answer to your question, I'd optimise for Google. I really wouldn't care what the other ones thought anyway. So,
you're on the money though, Mark. As long as your site is optimised for Google, the same sorts of things are going to give you good exposure on the other search engines as well. Obvious things like giving a page a title, making sure that the information on your page is human readable. It's designed for humans. It's not trying to be appealing to machines.
That sort of came out with the interview with Adam. If it's good for humans, it's good for Google. So, anyway, have a listen to Lyd. Lyd did an interview. I had a chat to her on the phone beforehand, and what it was like talking to Adam and all that, what it was like going to Google. Like, could you imagine walking down the front driveway of Google?
It would be very intimidating.
I would have thought. Yeah. I asked her that. I said, what was it like? Anyway, you'll find out all about it.
Continuing on from search engines, which we've been discussing over the last week, Lyd joins us from Palo Alto, and what have you discovered about search engines? You said something about title descriptions and page descriptions, Lyd.
I did. I actually had a look at to understand exactly what they are and how they work, because I'm really quite new to SEO myself, even though, you know, I have been looking at it for some time. But one thing I realised is, you know, when you type a search query into Google, for instance, and you say, I'm looking for red cars in Brighton, whatever it is, and it comes back with the results. Now, these results, they give you the title and the description. But many people, and it astounds me how many people, don't include them. So you know how in Explorer or whatever browser you're running, you have the little title that says, you know, welcome to Tech Talk Radio, informative, innovative, all that sort of stuff? Well, that's what people are not doing. And some people are having the same name for each they've got 20 pages and they use the same title for each page. And then they're going, well, how come Google doesn't recognize me or whatever the search engine is? So I thought I'd just quickly go over that because it's really quite interesting. The first thing I noticed was when I looked at the actual description tags, they seem to use no more than 65 characters, and that's letters and numbers and spaces, everything, when they describe the title. So if you're writing a page and you give it a title that has more than 65 characters, like, let's say, or Tech Talk Radio, whose title is Tech Talk Radio, Entertaining, Informative, Independent, and an Australian Tech Podcast, which is 88 characters, when you search for Tech Talk Radio, Google will return to you Tech Talk Radio, Entertaining, Informative, Independent, dash, and it stops. And that's 66 characters.
So the 66 is really important, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, this is not something that Google has said or anyone has said, but I've been just looking at different sites and it seems to be consistent.
It's a very good tip, actually. I think I'll change it on the Tech Talk Radio site so that it fits that beautiful 66 characters. Do you know how the other search engines handle it, or you've just looked at it on Google?
No, I've looked at it only on Google because I haven't had that much time. But I'm saying if you stay under 65, you're fine. And they'll put in everything. And this is where your keywords are really relevant, because if you put something like, and I'll get to an example in a minute, if you put something very simple, they're not going to know what you are or who you are. When you talk about titles, if you look at the description that comes under them when you do a search query, the same thing applies, where they can only put X amount of characters. And if your description in your
We're probably confusing people a little bit here. We're using title tags and we're using meta tags. In actual fact, they're actually called meta tags. And meta tags has many sub derivatives, I guess, or for want of a better term. Your meta tags has a keywords derivative and it has a description derivative, and that's the important part. Your page title actually lives outside your meta tags. It sits at the top of your HTML page, outside of the basic body of the page.
Here's another interesting thing. With the description itself, what happens is they will, again, use X amount of characters. Now, what I've looked at, I've probably looked at about 10 sites, and I've measured them, and the same number seems to come back, which is, don't use more than 160 characters, but make them count, because these are really important when Google's searching how to describe your site. Now, again, if I use Tech Talk as an example, what you've got is in your description, you've got Tech Talk Radio is Australia's premier non-biased technology talk show, heard weekly on free-to-air radio and podcasts, broadcasting the latest tech news, products and services, which comes to 180 characters. Google cuts it off at 156. So again, I'm saying keep it under 150 or 160. So where they cut it off is you get Tech Talk Radio is Australia's premier non-biased technology talk show, heard weekly on free-to-air and podcasts, broadcasting the latest tech news, dot, dot, dot. So again, you can use that to your advantage to make sure that you're using all your major important words in that section so that they know, or when they describe it, you go, ah, cool, that's the site I'm looking for because they've got exactly what I want.
All right, so let's just summarise it. We're looking at the title of, or the description of your website. Was that 65?
Yep. I was counting up to 65 and less. I'm sure, I've seen some that go up to 70, but I just, personally, if I was doing it, I'd make sure, you know, 65, there's five characters, it's not that big a deal. I'd make sure that you keep it under 65.
And the description tag was 156, you were saying 150, is that right?
Yeah, I was saying keep it under 150 and you're certain to get every
and
little bit
in. And that'll be nice now, and neat and tidy and look pretty swanky on Google.
It will. So also, the other thing I did, I had a look at a current affair. You know, your show, current affair show on every night. Well, on their homepage, they've used a title that includes 70 characters. It's very clean, so that's up to 70. But it all comes across and it says, a current affair, the latest news on Australia's most current affairs. That's it. Or the latest news on Australia's most current affairs. And that's very clean. It's very clear. You know immediately what they mean, which is wonderful. However, they don't have a description. So what Google does, for instance, it says, okay, they've got no description on the page. We're going to go to the Open Directory Project, DMOS. So they go there and they say, is it here? And as a matter of fact, ACCA turns up on DMOS. And guess which words come back in the description? On Google, when you
bad journalism, atrocious current affairs reporting, over-exaggeration and the chaser. What?
Now, if Google goes to DMOS, has a look at the page, has nothing there to describe the page, it goes to DMOS. If DMOS has nothing, then it goes off to your back to your site and says, okay, what can we use from here? And I've got to give you the best example, which is Harvey Norman. They have a homepage that's full of pictures and flash. Okay?
Yeah,
so there's nothing there. Yeah, nothing there for Google to see. So they have in their code, if you look at, if you view source, you can see that they've got, you know, no title. Actually, they do have a title, which is something like Harvey Norman Home. That's it, Harvey Norman website home. That's it.
And that's very explanatory page. And descriptive about the page, isn't it? Well, I guess it is the home page.
I know, but I mean, it's on every page. The only page where it doesn't appear is on the corporate information in terms of who the people are that work there. So what they do, they use lots of flash, they use lots of Java, they use lots of pictures, but there's nothing, and they have keywords. So they've got their little thing that says, these are our keywords, computers, electrical, store, camera, digital, TV, DVD, CD, gift vouchers, hot deals, printers, games, online, PC, flat screen, interest-free, mobile, laptop, notebook. Who's going to type any of that in?
Well, on average these days, you type three or four words into a key into Google, and that's a keyword. So there's no matches there as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and guess what? I typed all of them in independently, one at a time. Not one comes back. Like, the first 30 listings are not coming back with Harvey Norman. I did this on the Australian website, by the way, Australian Google, and not one of them, the first 30, and nothing to do with Harvey Norman. And I'm thinking, you know, they should. They really should, because they, you know, they. I know you can get PCs there. I know you can get lots of stuff there, and they have nothing.
I think it's a realisation for a lot of industries, especially here in Australia at the moment, that the web is now probably the most important portal that their business will have to their customers. And a lot of large businesses are still ignoring this because it's just this fad thing that's coming and going. But unfortunately for those big businesses, it's here to stay.
I know. Now, the interesting thing with their website is that these keywords mean nothing, like I said earlier, because on their page, on the home page, not one mention of these keywords, not one. So Google's going, well, hang on, these keywords that they've got in their HTML don't correspond with the keywords they've got on their front page, so we're basically going to ignore them. And, you know, I'm sure they've built the brand name, but now it's a matter of building, you know, their online branding. And this is where I think web designers, you know, who are making the pretty pictures with the flash and with all the other stuff, and they're making it all very pretty, as well as marketing people who know a lot about marketing but know nothing about technology, and they really need to start learning, because this is a big industry. This is like a huge industry. Anyway, I went on to search for HarveyNorman.com. Think about that.
As opposed to the .com.au?
Yes.
And what did
Guess
you find?
What happens? You get a page. You should go. I laughed. I literally laughed. You get a page saying, if you're here, you've made a mistake. No links. Nothing. So you've gone to a page that basically tells you there's an error. You're at a place which really doesn't exist.
So there's no domain, HarveyNorman.com?
Well, I went to Who Is and said, who owns HarveyNorman.com? And it's HarveyNorman.com.au. So you would think, wouldn't you, that they would say, hey, you've made a mistake. You've gotten to this page. Can't they just redirect the page? You know, just bang, surely. You can tell me this. You're a programmer. What? Can't they just redirect the page immediately back to HarveyNorman.com.au?
Some organisations are a little bit strange when it comes to that sort of thing, because, as I said before, they just don't think web. You know, there's a lot of, and it's a bit sad, really. That's what we're trying to do business-wise on a professional basis, is educate our customers about the way they should be running their websites. But a lot of large organisations still don't focus on the fact that the web is really probably their biggest selling tool. Let's talk about Dig. What do you know about Dig in the United States?
Well, Dig, and you've heard of the others, I take it, as well.
I'll mention them for our listeners.
Slashdot is the original, 1997 it came out. And then you have Furl, and then you have Newsvine, and then you have Netscape, who's now redesigned their site, and they have a totally different format.
They used to have a browser,
and,
didn't they?
They did. And then you've got Delicious, and then you've got Fark, F-A-R-K, by the way, and then you've got StumbleUpon, and you've got Reddit, and you've got Dig, as Dr. Ron mentioned.
So what are these sites? What are they? How would you describe them?
They're called social bookmarking, basically, and it's a collaborative way. They talk about how community members go to these sites, vote on stories or put in stories, and then these sites rise to the top of the list or go to the bottom. And they call it bulksonomy. They call it bulksonomy, which is, you know, I suppose defined as a user-generated taxonomy. And it means that basically you're categorizing and retrieving web pages and photographs and links and videos, whatever it is, and you're voting on these things and saying, this one I really like. Now, if someone uses Dig, for instance, and all of these pretty much run the same, you'd really have to have a look at them to see what the differences are. They're pretty much running the same sort of way. I join as a member. There's two things you can do. You can join as a member and get the opportunity to vote or submit content. And that can be your own content, but it can also be, I've read a story that Dr. Ron wrote, and I thought it was really cool, even though I don't know him or the story or anything. I can then say, hey, check out this story if I'm a member of any of these social bookmarking sites. I can actually, you know, say, let's say this guy, Dr. Ron, has written this brilliant story, and I put it up there. Then it goes into this little area where other members get to vote on, is it a good story or is it a crap story? So if it's good, it rises in the ranks, and suddenly it's on the home page. And what's happening as a result of this is people, they're calling it the new influencers. The Wall Street Journal recently, I think in February, did a story about the new influencers, where people that submit, members of Dig and Reddit and Spark and all these other places, if they vote on a story of some content somewhere out on the web and it goes up in viewings, I suppose, they're actually influencing what other people see. So there was a site called Fanst, which I think I briefly mentioned some time ago, and a guy at, could have been Dig, 17-year-old student, he turns around and says, okay, I really love this site, Fanst, and no one's seen it. Why isn't it better known? Next day, bang, 50,000 hits on Fanst. Now, you know, you can imagine how happy they'd be about it. So what's happened with this guy? Like I said, he's a student, 17-year-old student. He now works for Netscape, earns a grand a month, which may not sound like a lot to you, but, you know, think back when you were 17 and working part-time, you know, delivering the newspaper, whatever it was you were doing. I was working in the milk bar, and, you know, I got 20 bucks tops. So getting a grand a month would be pretty cool.
Oh, exactly.
Student, especially when... So these influencers are doing a really good job. The other thing that I use it for especially is research, because what it does provide is what are the topical subjects, what are people talking about right now and how current are they? Because... I'm sure you know, you go into any search engine, you type in some product that you're looking for, and it comes back with a whole heap of stuff, and you might actually get five-year-old information that you don't really want, and it's not relevant to you right now. These sites, you go to these places, you don't have to be a member, you can search the place, and you will be given, you know, the top stories about a particular thing at any given time. So they're great as a starting point for research. They're not great, obviously. You know, you can't just sit there and say, absolutely everything here is true, but... They're a great starting point. Newsvine is interesting. Newsvine does the same thing. They're also a social bookmarking site, but they have journalists from Associated Press, from New Scientist, from ESPN that submit content there. So, you know, you're getting a bit of a better quality, I suppose, story.
So the future for these influential sites is looking pretty rosy, isn't it? If, as you say... If you want to weed out the old information that some of the search engines give you, these sites are a great alternative to get information which is current in the last few days or maybe weeks. Is that a fair statement to say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's hours. You know, they will say to you, this was posted, you know, an hour ago, 10 minutes ago. If you go to the right social bookmarking site, you know, like Dig does a lot of technology and science, you know, and Newsvine as well does a lot of technology and science. So depending where you go, you know, you're more than likely to find topical, current, up-to-date information about something that at least gives you a starting point to say, okay, where do I go from now? So that's a really cool thing for researchers in particular.
All right. In just a few moments, we're going to hear from Adam Lasnik in your interview that you did at Google. What was it like walking into Googleplex? That would have been daunting, walking into the front door of the world's largest search engine.
I know. Well, no, it was really good. It's so big. The Googleplex is so big.
What are your first impressions when you walk in the door there? How did
you
feel? Walk in
the door, walk in the gate. Well, when you drive in, you're stopped by a security guard. You can't actually drive in. And there's all sorts of access points. It's not like, you know, you remember Channel 9, you drive in at the front, you get the security guy and you drive through. Google has 20 of these people all over the place, so you can't actually drive onto the premises without going past someone.
Is this common for this sort of, for these type of organisations in this part of the world? Is this like, does eBay have the same thing, and Microsoft have the same thing, and all that?
I have got to admit, I haven't been to them, but this is huge. We're talking about streets and streets and streets. I should go down and film it.
That's its own suburb, is it?
Or something. It feels like it. It's a humongous place. It's just streets of Google. It's huge. So once you get past the security guy, which was fine, I said, this is who I'm here to see, Building 43. So depending what building you need to go to, they walk you through. But, I mean, just walking through, everyone's just standing around having a chat. You know, there are a
couple
of dogs out there.
So you get ushered through the place, do you?
No, they don't usher you through. He gets you to park, he tells you where to park, and then he says, this is where you need to go. Bang, left, right, rah, rah, rah. And I did, but the interesting thing was, it's huge, I can't describe it, it's just mammoth. But going through, it's just interesting to see, like, their kitchen where they, you know, have their lunches and stuff. It's huge, their chefs are just all over the place cooking everything. Walking through the central eating, chatting, sitting area, and, you know, there were dogs there and people playing with dogs and stuff. You know, there's bikes there, there's little Segways, is it? They've got motorized scooters. You know, you just take one from one place to another. There's little, you know, golf carts that you drive around to get from one place to another. It just blows me away, the amount of transportation within Google itself. But just the nice thing, you know, having these little puppy dogs that you bring in your dog to work. They've got a sand pit there. They've got everything there. So
your first impression of Adam when you met him?
He's a nice guy. He's very friendly. He knows exactly what he's talking about. He's very clever. Before I go, I have to say thank you to Katie Watson. She was amazing, just walking me through, giving me all the time I needed, and making sure that we were all comfortable and doing what we need. But also Rob Shilkin, who is in Australia. Hi, Rob. And thank you so much for helping me out at the start there, because I was very lost. A journalist in Silicon Valley looking for help from Google, getting an Australian Googler responding. I thought it was just wicked.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we return, we'll have a listen to Lydia's interview with Adam Lesnick from Googleplex in California.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step 1. Visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step 2. Click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
Paul
visiting the relatives,
hard
washing
in
the
Charlie
car.
Pressing.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
If you were to ask anyone who uses the internet to name a search engine, or anyone who doesn't for that matter, chances are Google would be their response. 86% of Australians currently call Google home, so it's no wonder that when webmasters build and maintain websites, they do it with Google in mind. In recent times, Google has released a plethora of tools in an effort to educate and provide web designers a free and easy way to make their sites more Google and search engine friendly. Lydia Davis caught up with Adam Lesnick, Google's search engine evangelist based at Mountain View, California, to put a real voice behind those coloured letters we all know so well.
Today on Tech Talk Radio, we're visiting the Googleplex in Silicon Valley and having a chat with Adam Lesnick, Google's search evangelist. Adam's role at Google revolves around being a webmaster liaison. He spends most of his time monitoring webmaster forums and blogs. Adam's most visible role is speaking with and learning from webmasters around the world, particularly at conferences. He has just celebrated 1 year with Google. So, Adam, happy anniversary.
Oh,
welcome
thank you.
To Tech Talk Radio.
Definitely a pleasure to be here.
Search engine optimization. Wow, what a buzzword in Australia at the moment.
SEO. Yeah, certainly it's quite the thing here in the States as well. It's very much combines, I would say, a part of search engine marketing or SEM. So oftentimes people have looked at it as, how do we optimize our site for Google and for the other search engines? But I think maybe that's a little bit too narrow. The way I think is a better approach is, how do we optimize our site for users? And then from that, that typically translates into better crawling, indexing, and ranking on Google, and I would assume the other engines as well. So a lot of it has to deal with accessibility, compelling content, and oftentimes a lot of really simple tweaks that are both good for the user and good for Google.
Okay, what are they? What are the tweaks? We have to ask.
One of the ones that first comes to mind is actually the simplest, but one of the most powerful, and that's to optimize both your title tags and also your meta description tags. It's been surprising to me, actually, and sometimes scary to see even major companies having the same title and the same meta description on many, many pages. And since this typically shows up in Google search results, that doesn't tell the user very much. When they're getting ready to click, they look at it and they say, it's not very descriptive. It's not something that I want to explore. So by refining that, by having a title that mentions the company name, describes what the page or that section is about, can really help both the user and also help your site's presence in Google as well.
What should people be thinking about when they do write the meta tags?
You want to think of it as, particularly for the meta description tag, as a brief and targeted description, not a series of keywords. It can actually be a sentence or a phrase, so that it looks like something you would how you would describe your page to someone else in just a brief moment of speaking. If it looks spammy to a user, it's probably going to look spammy to us, so you want to avoid that.
Because that seems to be the common question, how many keywords, what about the meta tags, what about the title, how many keywords, what a question.
Well, we get that a lot on many different aspects of search engine optimization and site optimization overall. You know, what should be the keyword density, exactly how long should my page be? And the answer really is, use common sense. You don't want to have a keyword density, for instance, such that it just reads obnoxiously. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have a page where you have to scroll to the point where your hand gets sore on the mouse.
Absolutely.
But similarly, having pages that are two sentences long so people have to click next, next, next. We look at it from the perspective of what would a user want to see, what is actually useful. And so we base our algorithms around that. So there really is no set number, no set ratio.
In terms of links, that's something you haven't mentioned yet, but people do ask about links and what should we do. If you're going to be putting something out there, you want to make sure that it reflects directly on what you are talking about.
Otherwise,
what's the point? And if you do have hundreds of links, what's it going to do? So tell me about links a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you actually, just stepping back, you touched on sort of a fun aspect that I think people don't pay enough attention to. Actually, both a fun and important aspect. They're thinking, hey, let's get as much traffic as we can. Let me get as many hits. Let me rank number one. Without always thinking about the more core subject here, what are we going to do with these folks when they come to the site? Is that page actually relevant? Okay, we've link baited this huge section of people. Congratulations. But if they hit your page and they go, yeah, this is pretty dumb, and they hit back, you've just used a lot of bandwidth. You've perhaps lost some brand or some site goodwill. So the thing to think about with links is relevance. You want to be getting links to your site that are relevant to the content you have, and you want to be linking to other pages from your site that are also relevant to what your users are probably looking for. Now, if you want to link, if you have like a personal site and you want to link to your uncle's dentistry blog and your site's not about dentistry, you know, who cares? That's great. That's fine. It's not that we're looking over every single link with a fine-tooth comb. We look at patterns, both incoming and outgoing. If it makes sense for the user, if it's not clearly spammy or obnoxious, then it's probably fine and it could definitely help the way we view and index and rank your site. People joke and they say, oh gosh, if I see another, the top 10 ways to do such and such. And you know, it's become a bit of a cliche and a bit of a joke from that phrasing. But at the same time, I think the way we perceive link baiting is, if that content is indeed compelling, if it's relevant to what the links are coming in, then hey, more power to you. You're providing something that entertains, informs, or is useful to users, and that's great.
Well, that gets rid of my next question, which was, if I'm a supplier, should I get my customers to link back to me? And you think, absolutely.
Yeah, this is one important consideration in that context. We see this all the time, for instance, with blog software or form software. It says powered by such and such on the bottom, on the footer. And, you know, that's fine. We certainly don't see that as a problem at all, as long as it's visible and not hidden. But we do want, there's one caveat there, and that the site where that's linking into shouldn't assume that if they have 80,000 links on powered by such and such to their site, they shouldn't assume that's 80,000 votes, because that wasn't placed there typically affirmatively by that other site. So we'll see it as votes, but there is a point of diminishing returns.
Tell me about regional filters, because this is something way back when I was in Australia, 1 year ago, way back. I would use Google a lot, but we would get google.com.au. Here, that's not the case. And is there any regional filters that...
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think they're more subtle than a lot of people think. We're definitely not completely rearranging or including brand new content or indexing completely different content by region. Rather, we're essentially massaging what people see largely based on regional, cultural, and linguistic differences. For instance, one of the oft-noticed differences between England, Australia, and the States is the word football. So we think of something different when you say the word football. And there's also just minor linguistic changes. Like I remember when I first came to Europe and I said, excuse me, where's the restroom? And they looked at me like I was totally batty.
Yeah.
So what we try and do is we try and take that into account, those differences, and interpret what people are searching for, and then view, based upon where they are, how might they be looking for something that's different than what someone in America would be looking for. And so we may slightly re-rank some of the results or include a couple results here and there that would be different for someone in Australia than, say, in Japan or the United States.
So you do the hard work for the webmaster.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's, you know, you bring up the webmaster in this, of course, and I think some webmasters have been concerned, like, hey, I can't predict my ranking when my client is seeing something different here or from my site, the results are different in this country and that country. But we really see it as a win, not only for the user, but for the webmaster as well, because we're spreading the love. We're creating a set of results that the person in each country is more likely to click on and see as relevant. And that's better for the webmaster, it's better for the user.
Is there anything that businesses should be thinking about? In Australia, you've got to think, the other thing is we don't have the large corporations. I suppose we do have some, but not as many as you'd find, especially right here. And they don't have the money to spend on SEO and stuff like that. What are the key considerations for them?
Well, the most important thing is to speak with an authentic voice and with a language that reflects your primary audience. So if you are primarily intending to reach fellow Australians, write with a tone and with a spelling that reflects what Australians would expect to see. Spell harbour in the right way.
Yeah. Mum in the right way.
Exactly. refer to different cultural aspects and use language that is something people would expect. If you're trying to hit multiple audiences, that becomes a little more challenging. In which case, I would pick a primary audience and spell and write for them. But then if there are specific regional differences that, for instance, Americans need to know some tourist information that every Australian would already know, include separate pages for them. Even if some of that content is overlapping, that's fine. That's not a problem. You know, we want to discourage, of course, absolute duplicate or identical content, particularly when it's intended to deceive. And I'm sure that's not something that your listeners, or frankly the majority of webmasters, are trying to do when they take segments of content and repeat it. We don't penalize for that sort of thing. We see it as essentially an attempt to communicate with different audiences and with, you know, slightly different nuances, and that's fine.
What does blogging do for someone that has a website?
You know, when it makes sense for that site's audience, blogs can be fabulous. It's important to realize that just starting a blog for the sake of, well, it's going to improve my ranking, it's probably not going to be too effective in itself, because if you don't blog because you feel passionate about a particular subject or about your products, it's going to show, and people are going to not come back and not look at that favorably with your brand. But in the majority of cases where you do feel passionate about something, a hobby, a product, a service, blogging about that is a way to share your authentic voice. Mm-hmm. It's a way to have frequently refreshed content. And also to start a conversation, assuming you have comments turned on, to start a conversation with your visitors. And they love that, typically, where they can ask you questions or give feedback and get a response directly from someone that represents that company or that organization. They're more likely to come back to see follow-ups. They're more likely to share it with their friends. So blogs inherently are best for in the user context this way.
Absolutely.
And the side benefit is that because there tends to be additional rich content, it's going to probably be beneficial for the search engines as well. The only warning on blogs is that, like any good writing and like any good site management or writing actually for sites outside of blogs, it takes time, it takes effort to write content that's interesting, compelling, funny, useful, and also to manage comments, to be able to actually not just leave those comments out there, but to participate in a conversation. So if a company is going to go down that route, it's something you want to carefully think of and make sure you have the resources and the dedication, like any aspect of your site, to really see through in a quality way.
Is there any technical differences in terms of optimizing a blog compared to optimizing a website?
There's one consideration that comes to mind, and that's that in the case of blogs, sometimes duplicate content can be an unintentional issue where you will show the exact same article at 3 or 4 or 5 different URLs. And that can both confuse Google and can also confuse your users, because when they want to bookmark a particular article and share it with their friends, if they have the chance of bookmarking or linking to one of 3 or 4 different links, well, when you refine your blog, some of those links may go bad after a time, and it also can diffuse the page rank and other signals that enable us to see which pages are most relevant and important. And we see that most frequently in blog and also content management systems on the whole. So it is important to make sure that you have one URL, and this applies for all sites, one URL for each page of content.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, and when we return, more from Adam Lasnik about Webmaster Central.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard. And worldwide on the pod.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, and we're going to return to our interview with Adam Lasnik, Google's search evangelist, and Lydia Davis from Googleplex at Mountain View in California.
Webmaster Central. How much can you tell me you have to kill me?
No, it's the opposite, actually. I would talk about Webmaster Central until you kicked me out of the room here, because it's one of the things that I think we're really most proud of and excited about here. It is the way we see that we can manage scalable communications. And the keyword here is scalable, because there are a ton of us here in search quality and on the Webmaster Tools team. But compared to the number of webmasters around the world, I mean, my goodness, that's a scary ratio. So even though we've been building out these teams rapidly, even just since I've been here, Webmaster Tools is a way that we can share information, for instance, through the blog that's in Webmaster Central, through the help documents, which I think we have those now in 18 languages, I think.
Wow, that's impressive, isn't it?
And we're building out the blog. Actually, stay tuned pretty soon in some new languages for the Webmaster blog as well.
We have the
Webmaster group where there are discussions. But of equal importance, we have all the tools where people can see, how does Googlebot see my site?
Yes.
There are ways that you can test your robots.txt file to say, wait a minute, am I accidentally blocking out entire sections? So from information, from a way that you can tell Google things to help Google better crawl your site, and for ways for you to interact with the webmasters, I think it's just been an outstanding resource so far. And it's also a multinational team, so I have a lot of faith that you'll continue to see some really good stuff out of that.
A lot of people hesitate to join community groups like that because they think, I don't really have anything valid to say. But it's interesting. They shouldn't they?
Yeah.
You should encourage
them. And because even if you are not a geek or a great techie type person, you can offer insights into other people's sites. Such as that, when I was trying to order something on your site or I was trying to look at some of the full-scale pictures, I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then sometimes a site owner will be like, why didn't you see this link here? And they're like, no, that's like way at the bottom of the page. And people are able to help each other literally optimize sites, not technically, but from a navigation or from a user perspective, or they'll say, that just looks too markety. Maybe you could make it so it just explains your product better. And that, I think, more than any search engine optimization technical stuff, that is the key to really doing well in the search engines, to have your sites be clean and more navigable. And these groups, I think, have offered a lot of good insights in that area.
Robots text, you mentioned. Mm-hmm. How relevant is that to SEO?
Yeah, it can really be a great help. in two different areas. Well, I should actually take a brief step back for those who aren't familiar with robots.txtfile. It's just a tiny little text file that anyone can typically write and post in the root of your website. So right at the top level. And that particular file is what the different bots from the search engines, including Googlebot, look at to determine what can we crawl on your site and what are we not allowed to crawl. So, for instance, you might not want to have us crawl your client discussion area because you might be comfortable having that open on the web, but you don't really want it indexed. Or you might have an area of your site that's under construction, and you don't want that indexed yet either. So you would then put a statement that's disallow, and then such and such directory. And then when our Googlebot comes, it sees that and says, oh, not going to go there. And that also helps you in Google, because if there are pages that are empty, for instance, you have restaurant reviews on your site, and a whole bunch of restaurants don't have reviews yet, you probably don't want to have those show up in our index, because it's just going to annoy people that click on the Aqua Dining reviews. I'm sure by now that's got to have reviews in Sydney, but it's a fine restaurant I ate at, but pretend it didn't, and people typed in Aqua Dining reviews, and they get there, and then it says, be the first to offer a review, and they're like, I don't like this site. This is useless. Yeah. So it helps your site. It helps Google to make sure that the content that we're putting in our site, in our engine, is the content you want to have there.
Sitemaps, you guys, you, MSN, Yahoo, got together, made sitemaps.org. What is it? What does it do?
Oh, that can be a really useful component, thing to do on your site. It's actually a file that you place on your site, and you can use automatic generators to do your work for you, that tells all of these different search engines what all your pages are on your site that you'd like to have indexed. And it optionally mentions what priority certain sections or pages are for your site. Like, well, these ones, if you're going to crawl just this many pages, make sure you tackle these. These are the most important ones. Or we actually update these ones because it's news every week, and then these ones once a year. And so you putting the sitemap gives the crawler hints so it can better crawl and index individual sites. And the great thing is that this is an augment to the normal crawling cycle. So it can't hurt your site. It can only serve to bolster what we're able to see. So another brief example, if you have a site that has a very big database, mm-hmm. and all the pages might not be interlinked, and so it'd be normally hard for the crawler to find, by doing a sitemap, we can then see every one of those real estate listings or restaurant reviews or product information pages. It doesn't mean we'll index all of it, but it just helps us better understand what's on your site.
What about small companies that have between 100 and 1,000 pages? Is that something they should be doing?
I still think it's valuable to look at, primarily because, and I even did a sitemap for one of my own sites, just a fun hobby site, it took me less than an hour. I think actually probably half an hour to figure out, okay, how do I make this? Where do I put it? And once you do it, you can use these automatic generators to update it. So while it's not a total set it and forget it, it's one of those things that once you do it, it really is not a significant investment in either time, and certainly doesn't cost you anything.
That's the other part of SEO, I suppose, isn't it? It's a consistent, continual doing things to your site and making sure that things are updated, and it's not you do it once and then forget about it.
Yeah, absolutely, especially because sometimes links go stale, for instance.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more embarrassing than as a company saying, one of our most privileged partners is so-and-so, and then forgetting that they moved their site to a new domain. And so when your potential customers click on that, they get a 404 or a site not found.
Yeah.
So maintaining and always being vigilant about the content you have on your site, and also making sure you know what people are saying about saying about your site. Staying atop of that conversation and keeping a clean and consistently effective site, that takes time. It takes effort, and it's worth it.
PageRank, that one gets me. I really don't get it.
That's one of the things that webmasters really tend to focus on. And part of it is because there's that little green bar in our toolbar that always is there saying, you have this much PageRank.
Yep.
And I really want, one of the key things that I like to emphasize is that people really do tend to, I think, worry too much about PageRank. When it first was unveiled, when it was actually invented by Larry Page, hence the name, it was actually somewhat revolutionary, mm-hmm. in that even though it might seem common sense now, to use links into a site to determine relevance and importance. Back then, it really wasn't being done.
Oh,
well, nowadays, the basic tenets of PageRank, which is that how and what other sites link to you as, plays a role in how the search engines see the importance and relevance of your pages. Right now, it's just one of well over 100, maybe even I think as many as 200 factors that we take into account at the crawling and indexing stage. So by people spending so much time saying, oh, it increased one, it decreased a bit, or even worse, my competitor has this page rank. How come they're ranked in that way? And I think it ends up not being time and resources well spent, because it's really more of a symptom rather than an indicator of pure quality or what will happen. It's much better to try and look at your site holistically. What kind of traffic are you getting from search engines? And even more important than that, how is that traffic converting? If people are simply going to your site from Google, clicking on one page and then going somewhere else, well, PageRank isn't going to help you at all.
Now, the number of words to searching, like a search query, I remember when I used to, you'd sit there for ages trying to work out what's the right word. You know, years ago,
wouldn't
be going, okay, which word, what would best reflect what I want? Now you can put in, I really don't know how many words into, I should have tested it. Do you know how many you can put in now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have to say, I'm not really certain on that. I know it's gotten longer over time, so that people we see frequently, and I do this, you type in a big phrase from lyrics that you heard on the radio, and you're like, what is that song?
It
used to be there was a much shorter limit, and now I think for all practical purposes, you can type in pretty long phrases.
How many words are people searching on now, do you think?
You know, I think it actually has slightly increased over time, and that's my understanding. With that said, our ability to understand what people are trying to get at has dramatically improved over the years. The key tenet here, and this is, comes down from the very top, from Marissa and from Larry and Sergey and all the folks in search quality, is we shouldn't try and change the way people search. We should change the way that we're able to interpret what people mean. And so over time, we've gotten better with that, both by having really large data sets to see what people search on, what they click on.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also been easing in bits of personalization so that when we see what you tend to type in and what you tend to then go to, that gives us a better understanding of what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to type in really very detailed queries, but can just type in just a few words. Of course, you can always refine that later.
Quality of words. That was one thing that intrigued me. Not so much keywords where you have to have these specific words, but how important is having, you know, a decent style?
You know, for your users, I think it's really critical that at least you have a style. To be able to have a unique voice, ideally one that is, given the context, of course, that's professional and appropriate for that audience. So if you're writing on behalf of a Fortune 500 company and you're trying to attract, you know, large blue chip consulting contracts, you want to write in a way that your grammar is correct, your spelling is accurate for your location, and so on. But on the whole, Google cares less about the exact tone or even the perfect spelling and grammar of a site, and cares more about that the content is rich, compelling, and unique. So if you're mostly just grabbing snippets from other places, we can tell that, and we will think, well, you know, that in itself is not really a valuable destination. But if you're writing regularly and you're writing with content that users find compelling, however the tone might be, then the specific word choice itself is significantly less critical. I call these things, frankly, the smell test in a way. You know, I look at that and I'm like, that kind of smells fishy, or, yeah. That's totally what I expect to see from this type of company, or when I type in this word, that's the sort of content I hoped and wanted, you know, expected to see.
One of the other things that I've noticed and really annoys me, sadly, is jargon. There's all this jargon, you know. I can't even pronounce half of them. You know, search arbitrage, long tail, canonicalization. I can't even pronounce that. You know, it's what are these things, and why do we have them? Because suddenly all these people are busy trying to work out what these new words mean. Are they important?
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Do people care? Does Google care about these words?
If it's any consolation, hanging out with my med school friends is significantly worse.
Oh, okay.
Every industry has its jargon, right?
Yes.
And I would hope in most cases this type of specialized vocabulary has come into place to, you know, save extra words. Sometimes it's just because people want to sound important or want to sell high-priced contracts. Hopefully not the majority. Some of these concepts and words are indeed important. Like one of the ones that we have actually used and we've heard a lot is canonicalization.
There you go.
Took me a while to pronounce that, in fact. But what that actually looks at is, for any given page, for instance, there might be more than one way to refer to it. So a site might be at www.whateversite.com.au, or it could be without the www.
Yes.
And that's historically because the way servers were made, there could actually be different sites, different content on the dub versus the non-dub. Mm-hmm. It sounds crazy nowadays, but it's true. Yeah. So we had to train the bot to view those as different sites.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is nowadays when their sites respond to both, it can actually confuse both the users and confuse the Google bot. But the concepts, even though they might be jargony, tend to still be pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as sort of a key suggestion here is that people shouldn't feel daunted and overwhelmed by this vocabulary. They should feel free and completely unembarrassed, either on our forum or any forum for that matter, to say, hey, you know, I'm new. I want to build a great site. Can you tell me, help me out? What does this mean? And also, one other quick tip is that one of the sort of lesser known things on our search engine is you can type in the word define, colon, and then in quotes, put a phrase or a word. And that will very often give you plain English interpretations or definitions of
what that is. I use that all the time.
Oh, great, you already knew. Wow, you're ahead of the curve on that.
No, the operators that you have, I think, are brilliant. It's just that people don't know that they exist half the time, which is bizarre.
You know, it's an interesting tension for us because on one hand, coming back to the same thing we were discussing, that we want to make searching so intuitive for the user that they don't have to change or adapt the way they search. But on the flip side, we know there are a ton of power users that want to be able to really drill down and specify, you know, in URL colon.
Yes.
Or, well, actually, here's one for your listeners that I think is super useful and not terribly difficult. Site colon.
Yeah.
So when you know that, for instance, on a particular American university site, Princeton.edu, there was this great article you read, you could type in then site colon Princeton.edu, and then the name of the article or word from the article, and that will only show you pages on that site. We can do a better job of explaining, you know, how we work and what we do. And I think over time we have been doing a better job with this, but, you know, there's still room for improvement.
How often does Google index?
The answer isn't as straightforward as you'd probably like. We are indexing much more rapidly now than we did before. However, it also depends on the site. So when we see, for instance, a really prominent news site, or even a blog that tends to refresh its content and add new good content regularly, as we see that, we adjust the crawling rate for that particular site. So we will crawl it more often and then also tend to index those pages more often. So there's really no set time. It depends on what we see and how often that particular site is updating. One brief note on the same topic. We recently added a pretty neat tool in the Webmaster Central, where you can tell us actually to crawl us either slower, or in some instances, if we've been holding back, you can tell us to crawl faster or crawl more. And over time, we'll be giving more and more of this control and offering the opportunity for webmasters to tell us how they want us to crawl their site. But we've gotten a bunch of feedback like, help, you're pummeling my server, and I haven't ramped it up yet, or, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw that, and I was thinking, why would anyone want you to index less frequently?
Yeah, sometimes when, like, for instance, when I was in grad school, I ran a web server on my stupid little computer that could only handle, like, a few queries at a time. It was just for fun. You know, it was a site for my friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, some search engines were discovering it, and they could also be pummeling it really hard, going through, you know, a lot of pages very quickly. And then my friends couldn't view the pages. Now, that's an extreme example.
Yes.
But if you're even a larger site with a real, honest server, and you have a ton of pages, you may not want to have, for whatever reasons, bandwidth concerns, etc., you may not want to have us hit it as hard. Now, with that said, I think we've done really a stellar job at naturally, not crawling too quickly. But you know, we just in case we want to give webmasters that opportunity to say, hey, hold back for a bit.
And of course, the final question, how many servers does Google have?
Oh, wow, that's fun. Yeah, I don't know how many of your listeners are fans of Douglas Adams.
One, yeah.
One? Oh, we have one. So I do have to admit, it is one of my favorite answers that I have given before, but it still remains compelling. And the answer is 42.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for talking with Tech Talk
Definitely
Radio today.
Definitely a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there we go. Now we know everything we need to know about search engine optimization. Yeah, likely. All sorts of other things. You learn so much along the lines, whether you're an old hand at it or a newbie. It's like most technological things. They keep changing things. So you've got to keep up to date with it. Thank you to everybody who helped us do that interview in the United States, from Lyd to Adam, to you people you heard, to everyone behind the scenes. Greatly appreciated, and we'll hopefully be back for more.
Some pretty straightforward things there that Adam was talking about. Just make sure that your grammar and your spelling are up to scratch and your content is, I think he said, rich and compelling and unique. And if it's going to pass the human test, then
that's the rule of thumb, isn't it?
Google is going to look favourably upon your site.
If you're looking for the transcript of tonight's program, it is on our website. If you visit the techtalkradio.com site, there's a whole page there with some pictures from Google as well. You'll be able to see Adam. You'll also be able to see some guys playing volleyball, as you do when you work for Google, and the pink pelicans, flamingos on the dinosaur. There's some good stuff there on the Tech Talk Radio website. Just follow the links. Right, moving on. Telstra have going to actually, or they announced the other day that they're going to run a $300 million fibre link between Australia and Hawaii.
Oh, using G-Flush?
Hang on, I haven't got to that part of the press release yet. No, our incumbent telco over here they've announced plans for a submarine fibre cable worth $300 million, which will connect it directly to the United States for the very first time. And that's got to be good, because I've got ADSL too, and I find it very frustrating dealing with a 300 kilobit per second stream from the United States. As Graham would say, just do a few at a time. But it'd be good to get it. I'd like to get that 1.2, 1.5 megabit per second download happening.
It's a lot of money, isn't it? $300 million for a cable. You know, I know that. I know it's got to go a long way. It's got to go in the sea. I know all that sort of stuff. Big, you know, ship to put it down. That's a lot of money.
It's funny how 10 or 15 years ago, everyone was going satellite technology. This is the way to go. We don't have to worry about cables anymore. We'll just beam it, all the traffic up to a satellite and beam it down again. And it's the way of the future. Isn't that great? But things have really changed. Just the delays and the radio frequency issues that they have with satellites. Everyone's going back to the landline.
Bandwidth.
The glass is good. And in fact, there's a lot of interesting technology with fiber optics and repeaters and things like that. We should try and find a bit out about it on the show, about how far you have.
At the moment, just uses some fiber optic. But, you know, just you send stuff down fiber, one fiber, you send it both directions, and you send it multiple wavelengths. So it's wavelength division multiplexing. It's sort of fascinating, you know, down one fiber, all those things.
And the redundancy that you'd have to have in a cable like that would be, well, what's the point of laying a cable if one weak link fails? Then you can take the whole fiber or the whole cable out. Whether how they do it, like if one fails, obviously they send their deep sea divers down to fix a point or something. I don't know. It'd be very interesting to find out. But the project, which involves laying new cable to Hawaii, will provide the boom for internet traffic generated by the growing number of broadband services in Australia. So we can watch American television and all that sort of stuff, download things from over there. Telstra is understood to have decided in principle to build the link, but it's unclear whether or not it'll undertake the program itself or hand it to the Reach Joint Venture Group of Hong Kong Telco PCCW. So there you go. Telstra doing their own cabling between here and Hawaii. Good thing.
Well, I reckon $300 million is a lot of money. They should be investing that sort of money in that type of infrastructure. I think that's good that they're doing that. I mean, I couldn't probably afford to do it myself, but I think Telstra, $300 million, drop in the ocean.
Well, that's not what you call fibre to the node. It's called fibre to the island.
It is. It is. To this little
using
island.
Using G-Flash technology.
Australia, yeah.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Foxtel sues TV pirates. Did you hear about this? Boys, pay TV provider Foxtel says it's been awarded over $1 million after successfully suing a subscription television pirates. They got stuck into a mob called the Mod Shop in Western Australia.
Ooh.
Federal Court of Australia allegedly dealing with equipment, software and information to assist consumers pirate the Foxtel TV signal. Naughty, naughty. Don't go there and do your... Don't cheat Foxtel out of a gig.
Might be a few empty tables at the swap meet on Sunday.
Yeah, exactly. It's taken them 10 years to get to this level in their... business plan, so now they don't want to have the rug pulled out from under their feet, surely to goodness.
Ah, oh dear.
Surprised it hasn't happened with some of those game machines as well.
Well, you always see people chipping those,
yeah.
Don't you?
Chipping it, that's the word,
isn't
it?
That's the terminology they use.
Chipping a game machine. Oh, well, you mean the PlayStation things?
All those sorts of things, unlocking them.
PlayStation.
Well, they do that at those swap meet things too.
They do.
And at dodgy bills on the corner and all that sort of stuff. Caribbean markets down here, that's normally a good spot in Melbourne.
It's a big big business, isn't it? It really
all
is.
That sort of thing. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the finishing stages, and we'll be back with the odd spot and the website and the gadget of the week after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1300 664 882 and leave a voice message. That's 1300 664 882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! Oh, this thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of a
This week's Gadget of the Week is an MP3 player. Nothing special about that, you'd say. Except this one takes 4 AA batteries, so it's a bit bigger than your usual one.
Oh, that's quite a large number of batteries for an MP3 player these days.
That's right. That's because it doesn't have headphones. It's actually a floating radio and MP3 player.
Oh, get out of here.
For
floating.
The bathtub. You know when you're kicking back, having a hot bath, having a relax, listening to some music?
Really? I thought it was when you can play the Wiggles, when the kids get in with you. You do the hot potato in the bath with the little... Sorry.
Kids are going away. Yeah, you got rid of them. You want to relax.
So the MP3 player floats around the bathtub with you.
That's right. It's got 256 meg of internal memory, and it's expandable through an SD memory card slot.
What, on a little boat?
But is it Wi-Fi compatible so you can program it in the bath before you get in?
That must be the next version. This one doesn't have that. But imagine the possibilities, because you got a spa or a pool. You can do that as well.
Wonder what the sound quality's like. That'll be the interesting part. See if it's any.
You can't see how big stereo. You'd need a second one, wouldn't you? You know, almost, because the speakers would be so close.
What file formats are supported, Mark?
WMA, MP3, yep. And what's WMA DRM?
Oh,
that's in a Zune, I think.
Anyway, that's Gadget of the Week.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week.
Wow, without a shadow of a doubt, the Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week is google.com. If you go there, or the .com.au version, and hopefully it's still there, the little link underneath, which will take you to the wonderful TISP feature, the broadband via the sewer. Go and have a read of that. It's just hilarious. There was a couple of other ones out there too, which I think Lid sent over. And by the way, it's good to hear you listening to us. Lid, must be, what, nearly 5 in the morning in Palo Alto in California? We just got an email from her. She's listening. She's saying, aren't you doing any talking tonight? It's all been her. But yeah, that's the Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
That
is
photo
Google.
On there, the classic one with the fibre coming down the toilet. Very good, isn't
Google's
it?
Toilet ISP.
It's good. I love a bit of toilet humour, especially from the people that bring you, that search engine, Google. Tech Talk Radio's Website of the Week.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Showtime.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
a television production odd spot for you, Andrew. This will
I work in the industry. You cheat a bit, yeah.
Yeah, this will be close to your heart. The BBC has been criticised for filming its Easter Songs of Praise special in November, immediately after a Christmas service. Producers,
I thought that'd be something Channel 9 would do here.
Whoa. Not the BBC.
Maybe. Producers switched flowers and got the congregation to switch seats and ditch winter clothing.
You're kidding?
No, no, no. Jonathan Gledhill, the Bishop of Lichfield, lamented that it will give an air of unreality to the Easter program.
Yeah, but it saves the bottom line. That's what it's all about this day in modern broadcasting.
I think so.
Let me tell you the shoestring we work on here.
There you go. It's the BBC today. What tomorrow? Who will know?
I guess. Goodness me. And that's the show for the evening, gentlemen. It's been terrific.
Singing all the wrong songs at the wrong time of year. It'd be work for anybody, would it?
No. No, but it is a good cost. I know everyone does that. You do hostings and teasers and breakers and things when you've got people available.
You make the most of it at the time.
Not when the time's there. And imagine, you truck out all your gear and you'd have to go back and set it all up again. It'd save them thousands, hundreds of thousands. Go to the BBC.
Next will be pre-recording stuff for this program.
Oh, really? Never. Yeah. Never. We're live. Sorry. All right. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron and Mark Diggins have been in this evening. And thank you very much to Lydia and all those, once again, from the Google point of view, who helped us talk about search engines tonight. Next week is Easter, as opposed to what I said last week, where I said next week was Easter. I was working ahead of myself. Next week's actually Easter. We've got some highlights next week for you of some of the interviews we've done this year. After that, we have an Adam coming in who's going to talk about... he's a journalist.
Adam Turner.
Yep. And we're going to talk all that. And that's coming up very shortly on the program. So, in the meantime, hopefully your technology is going well for you. And we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.